So you've taken a few classes at your local community studio, and now you know that you want to make ceramics a larger part of your life. In fact, you want to build your own studio. But what does that even look like? And what might be all of the tasks and the overhead that the community studio has been handling without you even realizing it? What is it actually like to start and run a community studio? While we're at it, let's just complicate things a little bit more and open up that community studio in one of the most expensive places to live in the United States. Well, Lindsay Langsdale is doing all of that in San Francisco, and we're talking all about it on this episode of The Maker's Playbook. Oh, and by the way, she's not just opening a standard studio where it would be pretty simple to find what everybody else is doing, considering there are tons of resources to find beginning wheel throwing classes these days with the popularity of clay. Nope. Being a full-time maker herself, Lindsay is building a space where other full-timers and hobbyists can work side by side. It's pretty awesome. And I can't wait for you to hear all about it right after this quick word from our sponsors. Big thanks to Snow Farm for sponsoring this episode of The Maker's Playbook. Snow Farm is a residential craft school that offers 2 to 5 day workshops in 9 different topic areas on a contemporary farm setting in Williamsburg, Western Massachusetts. This June 2nd through 7th, you can join acclaimed potter and instructor David McDonald for Put a Lid on It, Tops for Ceramic Vessels, an in-depth workshop on the design and making of well-fitted lids for pots made on the wheel. At Snow Farm, you will dine on fresh handmade food, connect with a creative community, and advance your craft. Registration for all 2024 workshops is open now at snowfarm.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Archie Bray Clay Business, home of Bray Patch, a ceramic patching material that is best used for filling cracks and bonding breaks. Bray Patch can be applied to either green or bisqueware and fired up to cone 10. It fires paper white, but can be tinted using your chosen clay body and be covered by opaque glazer slip. Order anytime online at archiebrayclay.com. Now, on with the show. Welcome to The Maker's Playbook, the show where we talk all about what it's really like to make a living from the things you make. I'm your host, seasoned entrepreneur of 14 years, Rebecca Ikis Cara. Hey, Lindsay, welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
How is it going? Your room behind you, I know nobody can see, but it's so bright and happy. I feel like you're living in your pots.
Yes. Actually, I just recently painted this room and I sat down and I had a little bit of a clay nerd moment. I was like, this is totally deep yellow underglaze all over my wall, which is my favorite yellow on Amoco brands. So,
you know what? You're just consistent. What can we say? You know what you like.
Yep. I'm very in tune with what I like.
I did just realize this as literally we hit record and I went, you're in your pot. Before we get too into the weeds, for people who can't see who I'm talking to, how would you introduce yourself?
I'm Lindsay Langsdale. I shortened my name for my work when I was doing 2D work to Lin Lang. I make pots. I make sculpture. I do printmaking. And I also own and run a community ceramic studio in San Francisco.
And I have so many questions about all of those things. Because I didn't realize you had started the community studio. I recognized your pots right away, which for people who aren't connecting the name, they're knitted, fabulous, textured, colored. I just want to like cozy up with one. Even though it's hard, I feel like I would just snuggle with it. I want to get into the community studio. I also am trying like not to go straight into it and not talk about you and all of the things. So we'll probably just blend them together. But when did you open the studio? 21?
Yeah. August 2021, I was working for a larger studio during the pandemic, and I was laid off and furloughed a bunch. And just at some point, I mean, living in San Francisco, my life for the last decade and a half has been like getting laid off every 2 to 3 years and trying to find a job. So I just decided I was really tired of it. Also, I needed a space for myself, and I kind of, living in a large city, you have to have multiple streams of income, especially if you're a creative. So the studio, while it brings in some money, it like maybe covers some bare minimum things, I still have to sell and try to find other ways to bring money into. So it's kind of like a survival thing for me when I opened it.
Thank you for that, by the way. I feel like that is very, it's very realistic to me. I'm like nodding along like, yes, obviously, that makes sense. As opposed to sometimes I think when people see us doing these other things, it's like, oh, wow, that's wonderful. That's this, that it's like, and that can be true too, but also bills.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially in the city.
Especially in San Francisco. I mean, for people that don't know, you know, cost of living in San Francisco is radically different than for me in Milwaukee or even when I was in Chicago. I mean, it's right after New York, maybe.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I've got it a little bit better because I've been in the same apartment for 15 years under rent control, but I'm stuck here for the rest of my life if I stay here. But I'm very lucky to have the space that I have. It's very expensive here. I mean, a sandwich is like $20. It's, yeah.
Yes, and we're not talking like a really great sandwich. We're just talking a sandwich, not like, you know.
Well, there might be artisanal bread involved, but I think most sandwiches have that here.
That's fair. When you talked about, you know, having the need of having to switch jobs, was that in a different field every couple of years or was that tangential to ceramics?
Oh, geez. That's kind of a long story. I went to school for art. I was a 2D artist. I did a lot of mixed media and illustration. I got into printmaking as well. And when I moved to San Francisco, I was a framer and art handler. And it was right before the recession. And I lost my job like 2 years after I got here. And then I was unemployed for 2.5 years. So I took a bunch of classes and then finally got a job. Oh, my goodness. 2.5, 3 years later of after being unemployed. And I was an office manager. I started out as in an art school. And then I ended up jumping into the tech, working with tech businesses because I learned the lingo and learned how to get the paycheck. But it was not fulfilling at all. And I think about 2016 was when I became a slop girl at the studio for minimum wage, just because I just needed some kind of something that was feeding my soul and not just my face.
Not tech bro lingo all day. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's great people in tech, but it just wasn't me.
It's not a ceramic studio. They're just different.
Yeah.
It's different. I had assumed tech when you said every couple of years and San Francisco, but I try not to make assumptions. And that's also really interesting. I feel like we have very similar timing in that I was graduating and when we say recession, just to make it clear for timeline, I'm assuming we're talking 2008, 2009. And that's right when I was graduating. And people have probably heard me say this a million times, but I literally, the only reason I started a business was because I couldn't get a job. That was absolutely the reality.
Yep. The only reason I did office management, you know?
Yep. Totally.
I did filing in college for like work study. So I was like, I can do that.
Right? Like I know how to order, like put things in order. Yes. Oh, I love it. Well, so how did you make the leap? When did you get into ceramics then? When you got the job at the studio?
Clay has always kind of been in my life. My mom went to school before she dropped out of college and joined the Air Force. She was a ceramics major at Penn State in the 70s.
More questions coming to mind, but keep going.
She went back to school after she had retired after 6 years, and she ended up going into ceramics. So I'd go to the studio with her and dabble. I just never really stuck. I took a class in college too, and it just didn't really stick. During the recession though, when I started taking those classes, my printmaking mentor said that I'd be good at sculpture. Instead of signing up for the sculpture class, I signed up for the ceramic class. And I was very lucky to get into the class I had because it was a Saturday class. So we were there from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. each week for a full semester. And I think at that time, the whole community that I had just moved to San Francisco and started cultivating had actually had to leave San Francisco because artists can't afford to live here during a recession when there's nobody buying their work. So I just had this huge craving for community. Pottery is crazy like that. Like ceramics, the people in this community are amazing. So that's what really pulled me in and just made it stick because the people.
Oh, I totally. It's been a wild ride for me. I always felt like the world I was in was very communal beforehand, but not to the level that like
even just starting the podcast, for me to be able to like send a message to someone as a random girl on the internet being like, hi, can I have an hour of your time for free to talk? And people being like, yeah, sure, why not?
That would never happen in my old world. Like, absolutely not. It's wild.
I also feel like people in this medium are really open to sharing. I understand that there's things that people exclude from what they're sharing, and I completely respect that. I do the same. There's just more sharing. Painters tended to be a little bit more like, about what they would share. And it's like, you're literally, I'm asking you what color it is. I'm just going to go to the store and find out it's cadmium yellow.
You didn't forage the dyes from whatever. I was trying to think of some like old painting reference I used to know, but I don't know anymore. You're not finding it from the East Indies or whatever.
You're not grinding your own paints and making egg temperas on your porch, you know.
Yes, 100%. 100%. Well, so I'm amazed when I think about this timeline, because when I look at your work, it's such a style specific to you. And now like looking at home, everything feels like, oh, this all makes sense. And this timeline now is much shorter than I thought. So I'm like, how did we get here? Because I'm just impressed.
Well, so I think it's a lot of all of the mediums that I've experienced and played around with since, oh, geez, I was really little. Art has always been in my life. I've built these skill sets that kind of intersect now, and it's created a cohesive style, which I think is another reason why I really like ceramic, is because I started seeing all these 2D things that I'd make, and it would be like, oh, they're 3D, and now I can walk around them and touch them and play with them, and people can experience them in a different way.
I want to just double down on what you just said, because I think I have this feeling from time to time. I'm having this feeling right now, especially. I think other people have this feeling a lot, where it's like, we have found clay, but maybe we feel like, oh, if I would have found this 10 years ago, or oh, I wish, or oh, you know, this idea of like time lost, when really you wouldn't be making the pot you're making today without everything you did before clay. Is what you're saying.
It's probably, for me, I found my voice before clay, you know, as far as like style is concerned, whether it was making a print in various different ways. I did intaglio and a lino cut, or in college, I was doing wheat paste and stickers and putting them up around the city. So like that kind of thing influences my work too. My love for color theory and color and all of that stuff. All just kind of like gets thrown in a pot, melted down, and pours out to what it is now.
Into knitting, but clay.
Well, I also knit and crochet. And I think through the recession, when I was unemployed for so long, one of the things I always did was carry around a bag of knitting or crochet, because I was on buses all the time going back and forth between different campuses taking classes. And it also is like, I also have anxiety. So keeping my hands moving was always good for me too. Yeah.
100%. 100%. I didn't realize until like last summer, I think it was last summer, maybe two summers ago now, that like, you know, productivity and always moving in our world, and especially in the US, is like rewarded, right? We're kind of, oh, wow, how do you manage all of that? Oh, wow, look at all that you're doing. And it wasn't until about two summers ago that I went, oh, this is maybe high functioning anxiety. Just maybe. Just
a little.
Not a professional diagnosis here. This is just some self-reflection on like, oh, my inability to sit still perhaps is not something to be rewarded. Just a thought. Well, with that, getting into the realities of San Francisco, because that is a very specific, you know, I think it's relatively easy, quote unquote, to find makers and artists who are living outside of major cities, right? Because whether they enjoy that lifestyle or by necessity, it's cheaper. Are you still working separately and also running the studio? Because that sounds like a lot.
I've gone through some big life changes right now. I'm newly single, so I'm trying to readjust to life and budgeting with one person. So I'm jumping back into selling more to supplement. I think I mentioned earlier that the revenue from the studio covers the overhead and my rent. That's basically it. If I want to eat, I have to sell, because I'm single income. So yeah, it's a lot. I mean, and I'm managing all aspects. I have a couple work exchanges at the studio that help me out with the tech work. But you know, if I'm not there, I'm at home doing the back end stuff, you know? business, which I'm still learning.
I got you. We can chat about that anytime. That's the part that comes easy to me.
Because, you know, when I'm thinking about management of how much work it is to run a studio, and then the work that you're producing is not exactly simple. So I'm imagining that it's fairly time intensive to also do what you're doing. And just that balance between, like, I think a lot of people might look at a community studio and think, oh, okay, you're making your income from this and you can make your pots for fun or whatever you sell. It doesn't matter. But that's not the reality. And both of those are very time intensive things. So how does that work? Do you sleep? I hope you sleep.
I sleep most of the time. I don't get enough sleep as I should probably. I'm still working on the balance. It's a constant struggle. Also, the market right now in San Francisco for classes in studios is so saturated. Everybody has quit their day job and opened up a studio here. We have about 25 to 30 studios in the city now. So I rely heavily on memberships at the moment because it's harder to sell classes, and then you have to think about trying to, there's so much to think about. We're trying to pivot right now to try to do more intermediate classes instead of just saturating the market more with the intro to wheel stuff. And yeah, the balance is hard. I power through it the best that I can, and I make sure that I check in with myself constantly to, you know, stop the burnout before it gets too bad. And that being said, I do burn myself out. That's just the reality of it. And, you know, a lot of people are like, well, you live in San Francisco, you can move. But I've lived here for 15 years and I was raised military. So like, this is the longest I've stayed anywhere. And I love the city. I hate that it's expensive and not accessible to everybody. But like, I couldn't see myself anywhere else.
Well, and also, whenever I hear someone talk about moving, there's also an assumption on the resources it takes to move. I mean, moving somewhere is expensive. And then also resetting and starting a whole new studio and, you know, even just your own private space and not having community, to your point earlier, like, those all have costs. You know, being able to move is a luxury in and of itself in some ways too.
Yeah, I think it's going to just be a constant like readjusting and a journey of readjusting and trying to find that balance. And until I do, I sleep 5 hours a night.
It happens. Real talk. This is real talk, everyone. Like, here's reality. Right.
I mean, it's not the healthiest, but it's where I'm at right now.
The studio is also brand new. You know, I think this is the weird thing about Instagram is people see the finish when really you're in the thick of it going, okay, I'm still trying to figure, you know, in 5 years, where you will you be with systems and processes to get things fluid that kind of, you know, are off your mental plate, if not your physical plate.
One of the things that I do now is I have about 50 member shelves. The facility is 24/7. So one of the things I did when I opened is make sure that I didn't have to physically be there all the time to like help people. There's a few ground rules. We're kind of like a step between the traditional community studio that has the teachers and the staff there to help people and the space that tells you, here's the taped off space in this giant facility, fill it with your own equipment. We have some kilns in the back kind of thing. So that's one of the things that I did is make sure that I didn't have to be there physically. The other thing is I slowly let people in. I make sure that they at least have some kind of experience. And then I usually don't go more than 5 people at a time. And then I sit back and I observe and see how it builds in the studio. And I mean, even though that we have 50 members, I know maybe 15, 20 of them that come in a regular basis. So, you know, as far as like managing people, it's not so bad.
I think that's incredibly smart in terms of the pace of, even though you're saying the market is oversaturated, I also know I've talked to potters in the Bay Area saying there's nowhere open. I can't get a membership. It's so big. I'm assuming it's also oversaturated because the demand is also so high of certain types of access, I suppose. So to me, there could be, it would be really easy to open the floodgates to let tons of membership in, but then you would have a host of other kind of issues to deal with, as opposed to having the foresight to say, hold on a second, let's make sure people like jive together. And for me, from a community side, that just makes so much sense to be like, let's mesh before we add more and more and more.
Yeah. So also part of the studio, I mean, it's a place for me to make, I mean, selfishly, that's really one of the biggest reasons why I opened it. It was a place for me to make and have a little bit more control over my practice, because even though I was working at a larger studio, I still had to deal with their timelines. So here I have a little bit more control over it. But it's also, it was a way for me to, like, you know, I have friends that are like, they're production potters here in San Francisco, and they need space. So we have the shelf spaces, and then we have 8 table spaces that come with a rack. And for the monthly rent, you get the private table space and the rack. And then you can, you have control over your own kilns. You get a bisque and a glaze firing each month if you want to use it. It's been great to see, like, I have 2 real production potters going that make work to sell in San Francisco. And it's been cool to see over the last 2 years how they've been able to expand and scale their businesses too.
That was the most exciting thing for me in having a team, like, just tangentially, is like being connected to, I mean, it can be a little stressful because it also feels like a lot of responsibility and pressure to be connected to someone else's well-being and livelihood. But at the same time, that's that like support system of like, hey, what I've created here helps me live and it also helps you live. And that's really cool. You know, that kind of support.
Yeah, that kind of synchronicity between people. And I know that they know that I've got their back. They've got my back. I'm going to Enseca and one of the potters isn't going. So she's going to be there to answer the student phone if the students want to come in and work, kind of thing. You know, it's been really, like I said, community. And, you know, even through the big life changes I've been going through, I don't think I would have been able to transition to where I am now as smoothly without those people in my life.
Totally. Absolutely. There are a lot of people I've talked to, or maybe not a lot, but there's a few in my head who have definitely thought about this vision of having a community studio. I know there's some members in our virtual community who have really begun researching or at least dreaming about this idea of building a community space. So can you kind of walk us back maybe a little bit to, I know you said it started out of just the need of for yourself of having a space. And I read on, I think on the website that you kicked it off with a like a crowdfunding thing. But how did it, I guess pragmatically, how did it come about? How did it work? How did you even begin?
When I left my office job and started, I like to lovingly call myself the slop girl, for about a year, I was a slop girl at a larger studio. They had 350 members, 5 kilns, did 4 classes a day. We had all kinds. It was insane. And basically, I ended up becoming operations management there. And I did that for a while. So I learned the ins and outs of how to run a large space like that. And when I lost my job, I just was like, okay, now what I'm going to do? I need to provide for myself. And at the time, my small family, you know, and it's like, I have no idea what I'm going to do. And I just was like, well, if I can handle 350 members, let's figure out, let's crunch some numbers and figure out how much money I can make by handling like a quarter of that and go from there. And honestly, I actually started thinking about just doing like a small space for myself and maybe trying to do more of my work in cell. But I found as I started looking for spaces, it just made more sense as far as like cost to be a little bit larger. It went really quickly, though, because I lost my job. And I think within 8 months, I was opening the doors to the studio.
Holy crap.
I know. I have no idea how it happened. It just happened.
I'm going to hug you when I see you at Enseca, if that's OK. Like, I just want to, like, hold you for a little while. That is really fast. Also within, I mean, I'm just even thinking within the real estate. So in 2021, was it the beginning or?
Oh, geez. I don't even, you know, it's all very much a blur. We opened in August.
Okay.
So it was, yeah, it was about the first of the year, I guess, like February-ish. And then I have a couple regular collectors. So I was doing work in they allowed me to stay and work at that studio, which was amazing. So I was able to still create work and sell some. And then, you know, I didn't know how I was going to do it after I crunched the numbers. I didn't realize how much of a following and support system I had until I did this Kickstarter. I was like, I need to make at least 15 to 18K to supplement what I have to put in for myself and to start this thing. And I thought it was in Kickstarter, it was Indiegogo. I put the Indiegogo up and I was like, I am going to get like $1,000, maybe. And then within 3 hours, I had almost got $10,000. And I was like, how the hell did this happen? I'm literally selling sculptural hams because I think it's funny. You know? Like, I don't know.
That's amazing. I mean, talk about community again, right? Like when people say, oh, don't live in San Francisco because it's too move because it's too, like, community, not saying that it was only San Franciscans or whatever the term is. You know, you have a virtual community as well, but like, you can't do something like this without either that or a very large loan from a bank at very unfavorable terms.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, if we're going to talk about numbers, I'm open to talking about that. Is in the end, I took out a $15,000 loan after the $19,000 that I made on the Indiegogo. And that got it started. The other thing, too, is like my mindset going into it was I thought it had to be perfect. And I was very lucky to have the owner of the larger studio come in and sit me down and be like, just open your doors. You got 6 wheels, you got some tables, your kiln's on the way, you got a tester set up, a testing kiln set up, just open the doors. So, you know, it's still a work in progress and it's definitely not polished, but it's a space that people can make.
You know, the funny thing, going back to like our love of the clay community and how much more open and welcoming it is, I'm laughing because I think the funny thing is clay people might have been suspicious if it was too polished.
Probably.
You know, like we are a people of Crocs and socks together.
And mud, literally.
Exactly. I remember last year for my first Nsika, seeing people both who like took Nsika as the excuse to shower and clean up and paint their nails. And also people who I was like, you literally came from your studio because they had clay on them in the same place. And it's wonderful. But that is such a great reminder because I think it's one thing for to talk to people about like, hey, start before it's perfect when it comes to an Instagram page, for example, or something virtual. It's a whole nother thing to do that with, I was going to say, a brick and mortar store, which is also the name of your studio, which is so clever, to just literally physically open the doors and say, we're going to figure this out as it comes along. You know, you obviously know what you're doing to an extent. Don't sell yourself short in the fact that you've had a lot of experience before to where I'm sure the foundation was a reasonable, like, this is how membership is going to work type of thing. But
yeah, I basically, and like I said, the owner of the other studio is very supportive. She actually took me to my first viewing of the first space that I viewed. And then I looked at 18 other on my own, but she allowed me to kind of take her model and then adjust. And then I adjusted it to where I felt comfortable with what I wanted to manage, as well as like added things like the spaces for people who are like wanting to be more production oriented. Because one of the things in San Francisco is we have all these studios, but a lot of them are like hobbyist studios or studios where people are going to learn and they don't allow production at that scale. And I think that's one of the things that makes the studio, my studio, stand out more from the others is because we do have, you know, we have the intro student on up to somebody who's making a living doing their craft sales. I think the person doing the craft sales is learning from the student, and the student is also learning from the person doing the craft sales.
I also think that that is so impactful for everyone. I mean, the community studio I was a part of in Chicago was a glorious community, is a glorious community and so supportive. But that's part of why we moved, was because, you know, to only have one shelf space in like 20 minutes, Francesco had the shelf filled and then was like, okay, so what do I do for the rest of the week? It's definitely a gap that I'm excited for you to have in this space in San Francisco. And hopefully, you know, places start showing up in other major cities, because the balance between the resources you need to start and have, ceramics is such a physical thing. We need so much stuff and it takes up space, and all of that can be really hard in a major city. And there is so many studios that are, you know, there's nothing wrong with the studios that are hobbyist focused. We need those too. We need people to come and take intro classes and get into it. But once you get a little bit past that, it's like, okay, now where do I go?
Yep. Yeah, and I wanted that space for myself, but I also wanted to be able to give it to other people, especially in a city here where it's so hard to, and I wanted to keep it affordable too, which has been a little bit more difficult. My business consultant yells at me a lot because he says I put too much emotional equity into my business and not enough other equity into my business. But I feel like for me, my space is very personal, and that's the way that I want to run it.
And it's not, to go back to the tech bros, you're not, I don't know, I get the point that he's maybe trying to make, like you have to keep yourself safe, right? You need to make sure you're taken care of. You need to make sure that hopefully a year from now you can sleep more than 5 hours a night and all of these things. But like, it wouldn't be brick and mortar without you. You know, like if another studio does open up, what's the reason someone's going to pick your space over that space or vice versa? And at the end of the day, that's going to come down to like the soul of the space, which is
me.
Some of,
yeah. And yeah. Other people inside of it and how we, you know, collaborate and things like that too.
This is where I feel like, this is one of those things where I feel like the traditional business advice out there only applies to a certain extent when it comes to those of us as artists. There's only so far we can take it where it's like, okay, what we do is different than a commodity, for example.
To go back to what you were saying about, you know, the tech bros, right? Tech is all about like build, 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 sell, sell, sell. And for me, it's build, build, build so I can make, you know, and hang out with cool people.
Build, 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 stay, sit,
yeah, stay.
Pause,
yeah,
contemplate.
Maybe expand in the future, but you know, that's later on down the road.
Right. Or strategically stay small in order to stay sane. Options.
Yeah, options. Because at some point, especially with, I feel like with ceramic studios, at some point you're going to get so large that your overhead isn't really making you, is causing you not to really make any more money at the end of the day because you're having to pay more staff to manage, you know, 300 million people and
yes,
15 million kilns.
I don't think it's only with ceramic studios. I had that experience even myself in Chicago. I had a storefront, I had a studio manager, I had all of these things that emotionally made me feel successful.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And maybe I needed to go through that phase, right? Maybe I needed to be able to know, okay, I can do this, I can grow this, I can build this. But then when the whole world pauses, you take a look and go, okay, I don't need that anymore. Like, I know I can now, so whatever. When you keep the overhead low, you have more flexibility and more freedom to make decisions as opposed to, okay, I have to earn this much because I have to pay this overhead.
Yeah. I'm lucky that I have the ability to, if we sell enough seats in a class, be able to pay somebody to teach those classes. So I'm not teaching all of them, which has been really nice. But I think as far as like tech work, I'm also very lucky because I have people that really want work exchange. And we just make sure that everybody feels comfortable with the, you know, we are able to negotiate how things work and how much they work for what space they get. And so far it's worked out really well.
The question that came to mind as you were just mentioning work exchange is, I'm curious if you feel like because of your experience being, you know, as you said, the slop girl at the studio and all of it, do you feel like you've set up work exchange differently? I'm trying to figure out the polite way to ask because, you know, we all know in the arts world, there's a lot of kind of disparity between the grunt work and I think we all just accept it, right? That like, oh, well, there's the grunt work and you kind of have to do that until you get somewhere. And it's like, maybe we should be a little critical about how this works.
I'm actually really open. I'm very open to discussing what their strengths are. One of the things about management that I've learned as far as like office management and managing the studio is as a manager, you need to be able to identify strengths and weaknesses. I'll be like, well, you can have a shelf. These are the things that I need done. And I've had a few times where I've had to readjust what that person was doing because the things that needed to be done weren't being done as well because they weren't interested in it or they just didn't do it well. And so it's just about open communication. I feel I understand where you're coming from with how the awkward, weird feelings. I get awkward, weird feelings about having work exchange because I understand that they're getting a service from me in exchange for a service that they're also doing for me. But I also want to make sure that they are continually feeling like it's a fair exchange and making sure that I also feel like it's a fair exchange. So it's just a lot of open communication and like adjusting things because it's not necessarily the person that I'm not liking. It's the like not the slop buckets aren't getting done the way that they should be done every week. And let's talk about why this isn't doing it. Maybe you need to organize some fairs for me instead, you know, kind of thing.
I had a friend once who it was either a friend or a book. Now I don't remember where it was, but it was a matter of like, you can have the right people on the bus, but they need to be in the right seat on the bus.
Yes.
Right. Finding the right people is really hard in the first place, but then making sure they're in the right role in the right position is like that next step as well. It's a catch-22, I think, for all of us in the arts world, because it's like, on the one hand, you want to keep membership fees as low as possible so it's affordable for working artists. On the other hand, to have paid positions then is that much more of an overhead, which would require that much higher of membership fees. Or, you know, it's kind of like, in what part of the artist ecosystem life cycle, how are we able to support people, I guess, is where I'm getting at. Because there's, you know, there's some teaching jobs in, and we're going to keep it to the U.S. at least from my experience, there's some teaching jobs that pay really, really well. And then there's other teaching jobs that you would make more per hour driving for Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, the way it, with my teaching, too, I want to make sure that they're getting a fair wage, too. And so that's why I try to keep my tech work overhead at just work exchange level, because I want to be able to give my teachers the opportunity to actually be able to supplement their sales and income, their sales income with their teaching income as well. So I try my best to be fair with my work exchange and be fair with the cost that I'm, or the wages that I'm paying to my instructors.
That makes sense. And I suppose it's a lot different when tech work is not a full-time thing. Not I suppose, it is radically different when you have a team of work exchange so that the work can be divided between people and they actually have time to create their own stuff rather than the hypothetical exchange. But actually there's so much work to do that you don't have time to make your own stuff.
You have somebody that does the sinks and the sink trap. And somebody does the slop and the reclaim. You know, everybody wants to load a kiln.
It's not that exciting. I don't know. Am I weird? I don't think it's that exciting.
This is a little off subject, but one of the best things that I experienced opening up the studio is teaching people how to do these kilns. And there's all this magic that they think is going to happen. And like, it's like literally button, 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 start. Make sure the lid is locked and the peeps are in, except best pull the top peep out. You know, it's like not very.
Don't break other people's, like for me, I don't want the responsibility because I'm a little bit clumsy. So if I break my own handle, I'm like, hey, dum-dum, that was stupid. But if I break someone else's, then I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. It's, I guess people, some people liked Tetris a lot more than I did as a kid, maybe. I don't know.
I think I freak one of my work exchanges out. He helps me with glazes. He's one of my first work exchanges. He's also one of the production potters. He's always talking about how I tumble stack and it scares the crap out of him. But for me, when I get a big, large bisque kiln, I'm like, oh, I'm going to see if I can use no shelves this time.
Oh my gosh.
It's kind of fun. It makes it fun for me.
I can't go that far. I can't go that far. No, that makes me, I'm starting to sweat a little bit now.
I think that comes from being in a large studio like I was before, where we had so much production we had to push through and try and save space, but I got really good at it.
Oh my God. That should be, we should put this on a list of requests. That would be an awesome, I don't know how that could be possible for like an NSEGA presentation. That would be an awesome thing to watch someone tumble stack.
Oh my gosh.
It would have to be a firing that could work to unload in the time.
Yeah.
I'm thinking way too specifically about this now. I'm like, from Wednesday to Saturday? Yeah, you could do it.
Yeah, I mean, so the program that I run on our electric kilns for bisque, I think if I put a hold at 170 for like 5 hours, it's like 19 hours, a little over 19 hours that it fires.
Why not? And then depending on what temperature you're willing to open it at, we'd be fine.
Well, yeah, you know, I have rules that I have that I break, but other people can't, about opening kilns at certain temperatures.
This is now becoming a tangential episode of For Flex's Sake. Sorry, Matt and Rose and Kathy.
Absolutely hope that none of my members are watching this.
We'll delete this part. We'll take this part out.
I love it. There's so many other questions. I'm trying. My brain is in a million. We're both trying to have this conversation also the week before in Sika. So I apologize for the flightiness of our brains right now. We're like, getting back to your work and kind of life and how that works. You mentioned collectors. Is most of what you're selling on, like, have you always sold online? Or how does it, so kind of taking a sidestep away from the community studio for a little bit to how you are making and producing and selling your work individually, what does that look like?
So when I first started, I was really gallery focused. I really wanted gallery representation. I wanted to make big work, you know? And then I realized that it's hard to sell big work. And I kind of started looking at more online sales. That being said, though, the galleries, like getting into open calls and things like that, really opened up a Rolodex of people who then would reach out to me personally. And I think that was a smart move for me, too, as far as like being able to make that big work on occasion when you get a commission from some of those people that saw your work at a gallery. And that started when I was working full time at the larger studio. My work life was 7:30 in the morning, work on my own stuff till 2 p.m. when I would go to work and then close the studio at 10. And then if I had a show, maybe stay a little later. I've been running like that for quite a while. But okay, let me go back here. Galleries, opening up the Rolodex of other people, having collectors at the beginning of when I started thinking about selling. And then I would sell to collectors while I was working full time. I did a couple craft fairs. I never really did a lot of in-person sales, and I did most sales outside of San Francisco. So I did a lot of networking outside of San Francisco before I did. And I'm just actually now networking inside of San Francisco. I mean, other than my students and the community within the studio, the larger studio that I work worked at, I never really kind of ventured outside of that community as far as networking.
How did that work? So was that a lot of online networking then? Because I'm really surprised to hear that, actually.
Yeah. So I was very lucky to come into that studio at a time where they were bringing in all the artists from companion galleries. So I just inserted myself into all of those workshops and was like, I'm going to be the tech that helps you out. And I'm going to be the one that gets to take you to lunch. You know, so I made a lot of friends and also networked really well there. So I was able to gain more following that way. It opened up a lot of opportunities for me, like collaborating with some of them. Like Tim Ceramics is amazing. I love him so much. Also, the other thing too that I did is when I decided that I wanted to take this more seriously is I cold emailed or DM'd a bunch of artists on Instagram. And I was like, here is a Google folder full of my work. Please give me feedback. And, you know, some of them didn't answer, but the people that did gave me amazing feedback. And, you know, I made some friends. So I cultivated this community through networking on physically in person, but it translated back in because they're all from everywhere. Translated to Instagram. And Instagram's just really helped with that.
And so then that kind of shift. So you were still looking at gallery work and big work, but then kind of adding smaller things for selling online, or what that?
Yeah. So then I started selling things online and started marketing things on Instagram. I started with a website and I would sell periodically, just irregularly, really, on my website for a while, mugs and things like that. And then I think that kind of died down because, especially when I stepped into a management position at the place that I used to work at, it just became a lot of like focusing on that business and not my business. But again, all those skills that I learned helped me out where I am now. And then when I left that studio and opened my own studio, I started doing just story sales because it was honestly, I like instant gratification. It's really nice to get cha-ching, cha-ching from Venmo all day.
I do love the sound.
Yeah, me too. But then I think last year was when I needed to take a step back. I was going through a lot of big personal decisions I needed to make for myself. I stepped back from teaching and I stepped back from making a lot of work. There's probably about a year gap of like very little things going on my Instagram and social medias. And I'm just now starting getting back into it, to selling to help supplement my income. So I've started looking more into in-person sales. I was really excited to get invited to do the Pot Stars. And then my studio mate, Alex Beck Ceramics, applied for a joint booth at West Coast that we're going to be doing too. So it'll be my first time kind of seeing how the big craft fairs receive my work, which is going to be interesting. I always like seeing how new people and new markets react to things and my price points. As you know, collectors will pay more for things than usually people at craft fairs is what I've usually found, but we'll see how it goes. It's a journey.
Ceramics is one of those weird I'm finding, and I know people have told me this before, and I don't think I had the personal experience to like hear it as much,
but it's such a weird, we're kind of still trying to find our space because it's not always seen in fine art, or if it is fine art, it has to be a certain way or it has to be non-functional. And like for Francesco and I style, it's really, it's kind of like the antithesis of what you're doing, even though I love what you're doing. It's very minimal and very simple, which in some way, you know, which is difficult in a different kind of way, but that's a lot harder to see unless you know more about the craft. And so then selling at a higher price point is, it's a, you know, you have to find your people. It's just constantly experimenting. I'm glad you used the word interesting as opposed to, you know, it's like just constantly being curious how things will happen as opposed to seeing it as a reflection of your work or the value or whatever. It's like, well, no, we're just testing this out and who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think curiosity is really important to not only like, I think business, but also creatives should always stay curious, because if you stop being curious, then you're just going to become stagnant. You're never going to move forward or grow as a creative or an artist. And same with business, you're not going to grow and, you know, meet your business goals if you're not curious about how things will work. And if it doesn't work, you just readjust and try again.
I think for me, the curiosity piece keeps the business and the results of anything separate from me as a human, right? The results of something are just a scientific experience. You know, we have a hypothesis. We test, we see what happens, we're curious, we get data back, and then we do it all over again based upon the data, as opposed to, I did a thing, it didn't work, and so I'm terrible. It's like, well, wait, hold on. That's not true.
I find that a lot of as adults, especially my adult students, they're very much like that. You have people who are very afraid of failure, especially adults. And getting past that's incredibly difficult, I think. And people that get past that kind of feeling, kudos to them, because it takes a lot of work.
Totally. I also don't want to gloss over, and I realize we've already come up to an hour, so I don't want to take too much of your time, but I don't want to gloss over what you said about stepping away from Instagram for a year, and that you're still here and you're still selling pots and you have a brick and mortar studio and everything is okay.
Yes.
Just for anyone who needs to hear that.
Yeah. So I had my first stories sale probably like a year after the last one I had just recent. I think I had my first one in January. I think the last one I had was probably either January or February of 2023. And I was like, I don't know what's going to happen. I threw them up there and I sold all of them within 24 hours, you know? So it's just goes to show you that as long as you're doing what you're doing, there's still people there waiting for you to do it again, even if you have to take a break. And, you know, I wasn't completely gone from Instagram, but I wasn't as active. And I was very much in my own kind of world last year.
You were using it more for yourself or to connect with people as opposed to like strategically posting and being consistent and doing all the things that people hear about as the way to grow on Instagram. That was with air quotes for everybody listening.
I've actually never really been strategic. I'm just like, here's a snapshot of some greenware spinning on a banding wheel. Have fun, you know?
I love it. I love it because I think I get too in my head about strategy, about like, okay, I need, if I'm going to do it, I want to do it properly. And then I get too in my head about it and too obsessive and like, you know, elder millennial perfectionism problems. When really any conversation I've had with anybody, at the end of the day, it's like, hey, is it real? Is it you? Is it, you know, genuine? And ultimately that gets people a lot farther than like, is it the right quote unquote thing to do?
I find myself more attracted to the feeds, too, that are like, I'm in my dark, dank basement. Everything's dirty. Then somebody that has like this beautifully lit, everything's white. They're wearing white and working in brown, a dark brown clay, and nothing's all over them. Like, I don't relate to that, but it works for them. And that's great because obviously that's who they are. But for me, I am a fucking wreck.
Who was the potter who made? Oh my gosh. I'm sorry. I don't remember your Instagram. If this is you, please send me a message. But somebody made the video that was like them in their bit, you know, show me the Hobbit potters. Yeah, I forget who it was. I'm sorry, I don't remember. But it had me cracking up because when Francesco and I moved and set up our studio here, I was thinking about how to document things and the way that I wanted it set up so that I could record him throwing or all this type of stuff. And he was just like, absolutely not. This studio is going to be set up for production functionality and you're just going to have to figure out where to put the camera. And that's what we have.
I love that. I love that so much. I mean, that's the same philosophy with the studio. It was like, yeah, I could build these beautiful wooden shelving units, but I'm going to get some metal racks and call it a day, you know?
Yep. Yep. Exactly. You see so many people filming themselves from the front. But for him with production, the wheel is facing the wall and the shelves are in front. He can literally take the pot off the wheel, set it on the shelf. The shelf is full. He picks it up. He moves it up. He puts a board back down and keeps going. There's no plants behind him. There's no like big open space in the front where I can set up lights or whatever else. Like, that's not happening in this house.
The studio does have a Monstera, though. We did buy a big Monstera.
Now you're a potter in 2024. I should do this as a joke. I should roll in one of our plants while he's throwing. Stay tuned. This could be good. In an attempt to wrap things up, there's a million more questions I could keep asking. Is there something we haven't talked about that you feel like is a reality that people wouldn't know when they are just looking on the internet and what it's like for you making a living from the things you make?
It's hard work. And you have to have a lot of dedication. I think a lot of people, I see this with students a lot. A lot of people think it's all about the making and the fun parts about it. But there's things, especially when you're in a community studio environment, you don't realize all the back end work that goes into it. And I just encourage people to really do their research and make sure they're up for that kind of challenge. It's not just the making, it's the cleaning and the firing and the maintenance and the upkeep and like the bookkeeping and the marketing and on and on and on. And it's not glamorous. And I'm tired most of the time. I think one of my pet peeves about social media and Instagram and the way it portrays creative businesses in general, I think it's a little damaging. And I think sometimes I like that it builds community, but I have apprehension about how many people think that it's like they take a class, one class, and then all of a sudden they're selling things. I have mixed feelings that come up about that kind of thing. It's not glamorous.
You literally just summed up the entire reason I started the podcast. Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, even just something like having more than one clay body in our tiny home studio, forget it. It's impossible. Like, no, we had to work so hard to find a clay body that did what we wanted it to do with the different glazes that we have, because we had two clay bodies when we first started here. And it's impossible in a community studio. I don't think anything of it. I'm like, yeah, sure. Today I'm going to use this one. Next day I'm going to use that one. No big deal.
It's because everything is mixed already. My wedging table says light and dark, but I don't think anybody listens to that. People wanted me when I got the pug mill, people wanted me to reclaim white and light and dark. I was like, no, we're going to mix it all together and it's going to come out as a house clay and it's never going to get, the inside is never going to get clean. And if you want to use the pug mill after you've been trained to reclaim your own clay, this to my artists that have their private spaces, you clean it out because I'm not doing it.
Amen to that. I love that. Oh my gosh. Lizzie, thank you so much. I can't wait to see you in person, share a drink or a hug or all the things, and touch your pots. I can't wait to touch your pots.
Oh,
that sounds inappropriate, but no, okay. People go Google her pictures.
Oh, it was great talking to you too. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. I said people go Google her pictures. What I meant to say is please tell us where to find you on the internet.
Oh, yeah. can find me at Lynn Lang on Instagram. And then LynnLangCreative.com is my website. And then the studio is brickandmortar_SF on Instagram, and brickandmortar.com is our website.
And I discovered all of those links are in your Instagram bio because I looked this morning. So we will put the link in the show notes and people can click away once their hands are clean.
Thank you so much.
If you have not seen Lindsay's work, you really need to go find her online after you clean the mud from your hands. Because when I tell you her knitted, inspired, multicolored surfaces make me want to curl up in a grandparent's recliner with a 20-year-old blanket and take a nap in the most cozy, wonderful of ways, well, just you hearing that without context might sound weird to you right now. But honestly, it's going to make beautiful sense as soon as you see her work. I promise. So click the link in the show notes or visit makersplaybook.com/podcast and go check them out. Now, I have no segue here, but I do have an exciting announcement for those of you that have made it all the way to the end of this episode. Just before I recorded this ending, I took a good look at my calendar and figured out how I might be able to make another cohort of the Makers Photography Styling System happen. Like, relatively soon. In about a month. Now, it was literally just before I hit record here for this ending, so I'm still finalizing the exact details, which means the best way for you to find out first is to be on our waitlist, which you can do at makersplaybook.com/waitlist. As always, spaces will be limited because I will continue to be very hands-on with one-on-one feedback for all of our students to make sure no one gets stuck. The makers on our waitlist get first dibs at a spot before we open the doors to the World Wide Web. So if you've been patiently, or maybe less than patiently, awaiting another cohort for this 6-week course, then head on over to makersplaybook.com/waitlist and get on the, well, list. Big thanks to Snow Farm for sponsoring this episode of the Makers Playbook. Snow Farm is a residential craft school that offers 2 to 5 day workshops in 9 different topic areas on a contemporary farm setting in Williamsburg, Western Massachusetts. This June 2nd through 7th, you can join acclaimed potter and instructor David McDonald for Put a Lid on It, Tops for Ceramic Vessels, an in-depth workshop on the design and making of well-fitted lids for pots made on the wheel. At Snow Farm, you will dine on fresh handmade food, connect with a creative community, and advance your craft. Registration for all 2024 workshops is open now at snowfarm.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Archie Bray Clay Business, home of Bray Patch, a ceramic patching material that is best used for filling cracks and bonding breaks. Bray Patch can be applied to either green or bisqueware and fired up to cone 10. It fires paper white, but can be tinted using your chosen clay body and be covered by opaque glazer slip. Order anytime, online at archiebrayclay.com. Audio post-production of this podcast is made possible by help from Christy Kotzfan, with promotional material assistance from Queenie Malachy. The Makers Playbook podcast is recorded on the original homelands of the Potawatomi, Ho-Chunk, and Menominee people. We're the people of Wisconsin's sovereign Anishinaabe, Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Oneida, and Mohican nations remain present. Until next time, my friends, go get back to making your dreams a reality. Because together, we've got this.
This podcast is a production of the Brickyard Network, an extension of the Archie Bray Foundation for the Ceramic Arts. To find out more about our lineup of ceramic podcasts, visit brickyardnetwork.org.